Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody. We got a great one today. You know, for a change. Because this one is guest hosted by my friend and friend of the show, Catherine Rampell. You see, I'm taking a little break from the podcast. I've been doing this show for 7 years, and I deserve it. And also, nothing is happening. Well, Catherine can tell you more about that. Now, you might remember Catherine from her previous appearances on the show, but in case you forgot, I'll tell you why Catherine is so great. Catherine is economics editor over at The Bulwark and an anchor on MS Now's The Weekend Prime Time, which airs Saturdays and Sundays from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern. And of course, before moving to The Bulwark, Catherine was a columnist at The Washington Post for over a decade. You may remember that when Catherine joined us on the podcast right after Trump's Liberation Day speech, her immediate reaction was, "This is going to cause chaos." And chaos is, of course, what we got. Catherine truly is one of my favorite experts to have on the show. And today, Catherine Rampell hosts the Al Franken podcast. I can guarantee that this is going to be a great one. You know, for a change. So, Catherine, take it away.
Hello, everyone. I'm Catherine Rampell. Your pal Al Franken is off this week. I will be doing my very best impression of a former senator from Minnesota slash comedian in his place. Normally, when I am not filling in for Al, I am the economics editor at The Bulwark and an anchor at MS Now. I mostly focus on economic policy and the like, which is why I am so delighted to talk today with Scott Lincecome. He is the vice president of economics at the Cato Institute, senior lecturer at Duke University Law School, author of the Capitalism newsletter at the Dispatch. Wow, I have a very long portion of your CV to read. That newsletter focuses on the intersection of economic policy, trade, and regulation. And you are a contributor to the Dispatch Markets weekly newsletter. Am I forgetting anything, Scott?
My Bloomberg column.
Your Bloomberg column. So man, you are
you're
a master of the many revenue streams there, I hope.
Hey, I got a kid to put through college, you know?
There you go.
That's what you got to do.
So, Scott, you and I often talk texting at weird hours of the day and night because I'm asking you random tariff-related questions, among other things.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to have a longer chunk of time to talk with you, like during a normal hour of the day, about trade stuff. And the first thing I was hoping we could talk about is what is going on with the IEEPA tariff refund process. Like, explain what that is and where things stand right now.
Of course. So folks listening probably recall seeing some news about the Supreme Court overturning, invalidating President Trump's emergency tariffs. As everybody knows, last year, President Trump imposed a bunch of different tariffs under a bunch of different laws. The biggest chunk of them, these global tariffs, reciprocal tariffs and ones related to fentanyl, are the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. The Supreme Court in February said, no, President Trump, you can't do that. The law doesn't allow any president to impose any kind of tariff at the end. But the Supreme Court did not say anything about refunds, which was pretty expected by folks who follow the court and understand how the court deals with issues like this. Instead, the Supreme Court did what was expected. They punted it back to the lower courts, in this case, the Court of International Trade, to deal with the refund issue. Because we were talking about $166 billion in emergency tariffs collected last year, all of which were illegal and had to be returned somehow.
Wait, can I just interrupt you for a second? Why was it expected that the Supreme Court would punt? Like, isn't it kind of their job to resolve these issues? If the president is laying $166 billion worth of illegal / unconstitutional taxes, like, shouldn't they say, please give the money back?
Yeah, yes and no. So, first, they don't have to say give the money back because it is a longstanding law and policy that illegally collected taxes of any sort are going to be returned. Now, you might have to sue for them. You don't just get to wake up and the IRS sends you a check or in this case, the Customs Department. But in general, the court did not have to say, and oh, by the way, now you got to return the money. The other reason, though, is that the court tends not to want to weigh in on what can be highly technical issues, things that require specific expertise, like a court of international trade, on the other hand, would deal with all the time. One of the things we mentioned, we filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court on a lot of these nuts and bolts practical policies.
This is the Cato Institute, when you say we.
Yes, Cato Institute. Several of my policy fellow scholars at Cato and I filed this big, long brief responding to a bunch of the administration's ridiculous claims about, you know, economic calamity would befall the nation if these tariffs were eliminated, all those kind of things. But we also got into the refund issue. We said, no, this is very common. Refunds happen all the time. They happen for all sorts of reasons. And you, being the court, shouldn't shy away from ruling against the administration just because refunds, you know, you might have to give the money back. No, that just happens. Just larger in scale. That's it, right? But going back to why the court does this, ideally, and, you know, we were, you know, fingers crossed kind of hoping and praying that the court would weigh in and say automatically refund all the money immediately. But we generally, that was a long shot. And it was pretty much expected the court would do what it did. It rules on the law. The IEPA. And then it says, and now lower courts, you deal with all that nitty gritty stuff. That isn't our job, right? And so that's what they did. And the Court of International Trade picked up that the mantle from the Supreme Court. And I say, to their great credit, quickly decided to not mess around with any. There had been thousands of cases filed with the court wanting refunds over kind of between basically December and late February. So before the ruling, after the ruling, everybody was suing to try to get in line for potential refunds. The court said, no, we're consolidating all of this stuff into one action. And you, Customs, need to come up with a system to give everybody this money back instantly. That was great and pretty unexpected. Most observers thought that we were going to have to wait a couple months for that to happen. It took a couple weeks. But Customs immediately comes back and in very typical bureaucrat fashion says, oh, we can't do it. It's not that easy. We have to create a system and we have to do all these things.
So just so I understand, like, were they dragging their feet because Donald Trump didn't want to pay the money back? Is this like actually a difficult thing to do? Like, walk me through how much of this is just actual technical limitations and how much of this is we want to do what the boss says, which is not giving the money back.
Right. So, yeah, because you have to remember, right after the Supreme Court issued the ruling, it was both Trump and Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent were out there saying, good luck getting your money back, which had me carrying like my little torch and pitchfork about to go back to Washington, because it's crazy that they were bragging about maybe stealing $166 billion. But to Customs, to CBP's credit, they did not seem to be playing a kind of stall tactic. Now, who knows if behind the scenes, that's what they're trying to do. But in general, CBP has been moving pretty quickly for the speed of government. I mean, they have this system now established. They've started the process. Now, that said, this is not all wine and roses, because there have been instances of blanket refunds going back just a few, you know, just about a decade. Within the last decade, we've had two really big bulk refunds. This program called the Generalized System of Preferences, which gives duty-free access to to developing countries for certain imports. Well, that program lapses every once in a while, and then Congress will reauthorize it, and they'll reauthorize it retroactively. So there'll be like 2-3 years of tariffs that had been collected that shouldn't have been had GSP been in place. And Customs has literally just issued notice, pushed a button, and everybody gets a check or a virtual, you know, it goes back into their account. So theoretically, this could have been the press of a button, but for whatever reason, and I don't know why, and it really depends on who you ask. You know, I am not a trade lawyer any longer. I never did customs work at that kind of granular level of like dealing with like ACE forms and stuff, which is the automated system. But if you ask half of the customs bar, they will say, oh, this is all BS. They could have just pushed a button. If you ask the other half, and typically the ones that are like former customs officials, so it's kind of like the bureaucrats and the libertarians fighting each other, they'll say, no, you can't. It's not that easy. You have to deal with this and that. I don't know who's right. I'm a libertarian, so I'm skeptical, but I do think customs deserves a tiny bit of credit, a little more than a tiny, that they are moving to give this money back.
Okay, and do we know like how much has gone out at this point?
Yeah, not that much. We're looking at somewhere over $10 billion has actually hit bank accounts. Somewhere around maybe $50 billion has supposedly been authorized, which is pretty decent because we're now about in like the second month of the process being live. Now, there's a big asterisk on that $50 billion, though, and that gets into, I think, there's a ton of open questions. The first asterisk, of course, is that $50 billion sounds like a lot, but it's only a third, not even a third of $166 billion, plus interest, because they owe 4-6% interest on this stuff. We've calculated over at Cato, we're already at about $6 billion in total interest on that $166 billion nut. And so $50 billion sounds like great, but I mean, even then, but there's another asterisk buried in there. And that's that customs has been very clear that it's going to scrutinize the forms that importers submit to get their money back. Cause they have to submit paperwork. It's all, you know, typical paperwork. And they're going to then apply the tariffs that would have been in place, but for the IEEPA tariffs, cause Trump's tariffs are extremely convoluted. It's one of the big problems with them. They're very complex. They stack on top of each other and they do all these things. So customs had to go back and basically say, aha, if the IEEPA tariffs never existed, there would have been some steel tariffs on there. There would have been some auto tariffs. So we have to recalculate everything. So they're even though they say we've gone through $50 billion, that might only end up generating, and this is totally random, $40 billion hitting people's bank accounts. So we don't know any of that yet.
Well, but so if you're a business and you paid however many millions of dollars last year, and a bunch of them have, do you have any idea like how much money is even expected to hit your bank account? Like it seems like they're like throwing stuff at the ceiling and saying, okay, this is the amount that's coming back. And
so I think you can ballpark it because, you know, let's face it, these especially sophisticated importers, the Costcos of the world, the GMs of the world, they have pretty advanced systems that can kind of recalculate what they owe. So for them, I think they can come pretty close. And we've seen some really large importers say we are expecting $500 million or, you know, $1.5 billion in refunds, they've reported that to their shareholders, and you know they're bound by SEC disclosure rules, and so I think they can do that. Now, small guys have no idea, and this is one of the great inequities that's emerging in this system, and I think it's a big problem. Is that we really at this point. We should expect, without some sort of intervention by Congress or some sort of change by customs, we should expect that even after the system, the refunds are quote unquote complete, the feds are going to get to keep, tens of billions of illegally collected tariffs, because by opting into the system, by having to submit forms to customs, it requires a level of sophistication that a lot of the smallest importers simply don't have. You know, these are folks that maybe import $10,000 of stuff a year. And so they maybe are owed $1,500 by the government, right? So for those folks, then they're like, well, I mean, the time and effort it's going to take for me to get a lawyer and figure out all this stuff, it's not worth $1,500. Others will say, well, actually, I'm owed $15,000. But, you know, I did all this paperwork myself, and I'm not confident that during the chaos that was 2025 tariff time, and if you ask anybody in the customs field last year, I mean, it was just ripping your hair out constantly because the rules were changing in 24 hours, and they didn't even have the instructions to fill out the paperwork. So you've heard some importers say, you know what, we're owed 15 grand and we're still not going to do it because the last thing I want is to get a call from customs that says I now owe penalties because I did it wrong.
Yeah. I've heard this anecdotally that there are companies out there that are worried about filing for the money that the Supreme Court suggests that they are legally owed, right? That these were illegal taxes, unconstitutional taxes that the president made them pay. And they're just like, I'm not going to bother because I don't know about what kind of retaliation I might be due for, you know, even if I'm in the right here. Like it was reported that Amazon wasn't filing for a refund. I don't know if that's still the case. I've contacted Amazon like six times in the past week and they have not replied. But I've talked with smaller businesses, same deal. They're worried that like, however much money they might be getting back, if they actually did get something wrong, that would be costly. And then even if they didn't get something wrong, having to prove their innocence, just like, you know, going through an IRS audit is costly, even if at the end of the day you don't owe anything, that this will not be worth it. And I don't have a great sense of like whether those are valid concerns. Donald Trump did say publicly that he would be paying attention to who doesn't file. He said that on CNBC. So it's not like it's totally outside of the realm of possibility. But like, is it a reasonable fear that this process could be weaponized against companies?
Yeah, you know, the weaponized is a bit of a loaded term, but I think that it's definitely true that you are exposing yourself when you to potential scrutiny, retaliation, political retribution, consumer lawsuits as well, right? Because consumers are mad they're not getting their refunds. And look, I, as a consumer myself, I have a lot of sympathy there, but legally, the process has to start with the importer. You can't get really mad at the Walmarts, Costcos, and GMs of the world for getting their money back. You have to, you know, deal with that later. You can't just be like, I want my check, right? So, but some companies might just be like, you know what? I don't want to get sued. I don't want to have to be in court. I don't want to have Donald Trump notice that I got a big refund and suddenly call me and tell me I have to give it back, even though I ate a lot of the tariff. Because you got to remember, last year, a lot of companies didn't pass on these tariffs. They were waiting for the court decisions. They just simply wanted to maintain market share and keep saying their clients' good graces. For whatever reason, some companies passed them on, a lot of companies passed them on, but a lot of them didn't.
Or some combination. They passed along part of the cost and they ate part
spread,
of the cost.
And they spread it out over different merchandise and they did all sorts of things to you know, deal with that pain. So, but I think it just is going to depend on the company. I think, you know, every company is going through, when it comes to tariff rings, a cost benefit, right? Is the juice worth the squeeze? And I think this is, you know, one of the great inequities of all of the Trump tariff saga we've been through, is that it just is repeatedly screws over small business. Yeah. So small business gets screwed over on the front end because tariffs have to be paid up front. It's not like an income tax, right? You don't have money yet from the sales of the stuff you're paying tariffs on. You don't have the capital runways and the supply chains and, of course, the lawyers and lobbyists to help you minimize your duty liability or lobby for an exemption. You don't have any of that. So you're paying the tariffs up front. And then on refunds, you're like, ugh, do I really want to do this to get maybe $10,000 back, right? Do I want to spend $10,000 on lawyers to get $10,000 back? Even though $10,000 for a small business, that can be the difference between a profit year, a profitable year, and having a loss. And that stinks. And it's so they get screwed on the front end, they get screwed on the back end. But I think that's where we are. And I think that's where we're gonna end up. You know, we've been saying at Cato, I've been yelling it from the mountaintops that there is a role for Congress here, and that is to mandate a blanket automatic refund system, just like they did with that GSP program. Go tell Customs, figure it out. Whoever paid whatever dollar amount, give it back. The end. That's how it works. And they just Congress, of course, you know, they don't do much of anything. They're not doing that. And because of this, because the system that Customs has created is this opt-in system, the pretty heavily bureaucratic system, you're inevitably going to have, it's going to kind of filter out folks through these various stages. And at the end, I don't know. My guess is we'll be here in a year. The process will basically be finished, and you'll be looking at maybe, you know, 30, 40 billion that's sitting around still with the government, because they've, you know, I mean, look, 125 billion in refunds, pretty good, but not when you're keeping 40 billion that mainly came from American businesses, and especially small businesses.
Yeah, and their customers as well. Yeah, right. The point about small businesses being screwed is one that I hear over and over and over again when I am talking with the people who run smaller businesses. They're pissed off that basically they don't have the deep pockets and connections to advocate for exemptions, right? Like, you know, they don't have a Tim Cook who can go to the White House and give a golden trophy to the president so that their products can be exempted from these tariffs. And they're like, why am I, well, you know, like I've talk to the guy who was the CEO of the company that makes Trump's favorite shoes, Florsheim shoes. You know, the shoes, you see all these photos of like Marco Rubio and other people wearing shoes that are too big. It's Florsheim shoes. And, you know, he was saying like, why are my shoes, you know, of strategic interest to the United States? I don't think they are. Right. And same thing, somebody who makes sunglasses, somebody who imports some kind of obscure alcohol product. They're like, what? I get it with chips. I get it with, you know, rare earths or whatever, like certain other things. But why is my thing of strategic interest? And then on top, you know, like, and I can't, I don't have the connections to like make that argument directly to Bessent or to Lutnick or to Trump.
Exactly. And they don't have the supply chain flexibility. You know, a lot of major multinationals have factories in several countries, including in the United States, right? And the little guys, they can't say, oh, okay, now the China tariff is 100%. I'm just going to go switch over to Mexico, or I'm going to rejigger some things and up production at my U.S. plant. No, they're importing from China. That's it. And they're paying that 100%. And I think the other thing with small businesses, and you hear this a ton, is a lot of smaller businesses do contract manufacturing, and a lot of it is in China because China just has the scale. And so they it's their stuff that's sitting on the boat coming to them. It's their intellectual property. They own it already. It's not like they went out to China or us and bought. It's their products, their designs. And the tariffs happened so quickly that they couldn't. What are you going to do? The order has been placed. In a lot of cases, it was literally, you know, getting wheeled out to the boat, and they just have to pay the tariff, or they have to reject the shipment, and then they have nothing to sell, right? And you hear that repeatedly. And I think, you know, there are many criticisms of the Trump tariffs, but even if you are a protectionist, you know, God help you. You can design a system that makes some sense, right? Okay, we're gonna give you a runway to boost your domestic production or get out of China or do anything like that. We didn't do any of that, right? I mean, we just said one day Trump woke up and said Liberation Day is coming, and then a couple of weeks later you had these sky high tariffs on all these products from all these countries. China retaliated. Next thing you know, we were at like 140%. On Chinese imports, which is, you know, it's an effective embargo. And for the smallest guys that can't get an exemption like Tim Cook did, that's your choice is, you know, pay the man or go bankrupt. And now you paid the man, You survived, and now you're trying to get your money back, and you're dealing with, you know, maybe putting another bullseye on your back, or at least just getting a call from customs and saying you screwed up your paperwork, and oh, by the way, you owe money.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
Is there any evidence that there has been more reshoring in the past year?
A little, but more anecdotal. Nothing in the hard data yet. So, you know, one of the hard things for you and me, and you certainly know this, is that the data are all lagged by, in some cases, like 6 months. You have to wait before you're getting the data you want. Especially if you want to wait, if you want to be a real nerd and wait for the revisions, because, you know, the initial estimates are always junk. So I think the long and short of it is there's been no noticeable uptick.
I mean, there are fewer manufacturing jobs today than there were when Trump took
office. And jobs, you know, that can be for all sorts of reasons, because productivity in manufacturing has gone up a little bit. Output has gone up a little bit. But like actual like hard investment, it's down from the kind of Biden boom years, CHIPS Act, IRA, and just coming out of the pandemic. The investment's actually slowed from that. If you look at like BEA, for some reason, produces an automotive specific data set, which that's the Bureau of Economic. Yeah, it's great because you can actually look at automotive output and investment, and they now have that through the first quarter. It's actually down a little bit from early last year, so it's kind of trending in the wrong direction.
And that's because what they're like paying more on tariffs on steel and
aluminum, tariffs and the uncertainty, right? That's the other big thing. You heard this a million times last year from companies large and small, that they don't know what the heck the tariff is going to be tomorrow. They don't know what the heck the deal Trump is negotiating and how it's going to change. And all of that uncertainty, just, it doesn't mean they're going to go out of business. It just means they aren't going to spend. They're not going to hire. They're not going to invest. I think one of the reasons why we're in this kind of low fire environment outside of, you know, the non-cyclical industries like healthcare is because you had a lot of folks going, I don't know what's going on, right? And I'm going to wait. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why we've seen maybe a little uptick since January, part of it is because of the full expensing and tax stuff, but part of it is that the tariffs, the Supreme Court took away Trump's favorite tariff toy, which, you know, the IEEPA is that little tariff switch in the Oval Office. And that's just instant and permanent uncertainty in dealing with $4 trillion in annual goods trade. I mean, that's a lot of money, even for a $30 trillion U.S. economy. So going back to, by the way, the BEA automotive data set, I'll just say, you look at that, it's pretty much flat. And overall, manufacturing last year was down for most of the year. It started to come up a little bit at the end of the year, but certainly there's no boom there. The only thing, if I'm going to play devil's advocate, is Trump has all these deals and all these investments were prospective, right? So maybe something happens this year, but with Iran, if I had to bet on it, I would say we're not going to, 2026 won't be a boom year either for manufacturing.
Okay. So, but this money is hitting companies' bank accounts. And so to the extent that, like, I take your point about uncertainty was a large part of the reason why companies were maybe not expanding and not investing and whatever, and may have even been laying off workers. Now this money is flowing back to them, and at least in part. Does that suggest that, like, the golden age that Donald Trump has been promising will soon be upon us because he has stopped in some ways obstructing that golden, like, you know, or the Supreme Court has forced him to stop obstructing, you know, this economic development. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no. By the way, big shout out to The Economist this week, which did a great piece looking at, they did some kind of back of napkin math on what the U.S. economy might be doing without all of the tariffs and the deportations and the uncertainty.
Oh, it's pretty cool. I got to check this out.
It's neat. And look, this is all kind of, again, it's napkin math. This is not like really rigorous analysis, but it's pretty interesting, right? They said that, you know, the U.S. economy could be growing above 4% with this AI boom, but the deportations and the tariffs have us, we're probably like a 1 percentage point drag off what we could be doing because of these dumb unforced errors. Pretty interesting. The unfortunate thing is that U.S. law has alternatives for Donald Trump to reimpose tariffs. And so he's already gone, you know, the day after the Supreme Court decision, they implemented the Section 122 global tariffs of 10%. They've launched about 40 new investigations under Section 301, which is deals with unfair trading practices abroad. And they have all these Section 232 tariffs and investigations. Section 232 is for national security. So long story short, there's a lot of numbers in there. Long story short is there are other laws that are going to allow Trump to put together most of the IEEPA tariff wall just using other statutes, some of which, like the 232 and 301s, those are more legally durable. I think, you know, 122 is questionable. The lower court, the Court of International Trade, ruled the 122 tariffs illegal. Good, right? But you got to go to the Federal Circuit, and then you got to maybe go to the Supreme Court. I think most folks say the chances of ultimate victory in the 122 case are, they're not terrible, but they're not as good as IEEPA. IEEPA was a pretty clear-cut case where the statute never mentioned tariffs. It had never been used to impose tariffs. If you knew the legislative history of the law, it wasn't meant to be a tariff law. It doesn't actually even make any sense as a tariff law because it's meant to be like a wartime thing, right? And in war, yes, you might block imports from a bad actor. You might freeze all of their assets, but you're not going to just like apply a 10% tariff, right? It doesn't make any sense. Oh, Nazi Germany, 10% tariff on your tanks, right? That's stupid. So it made good sense that IEEPA would get invalidated. 122 is harder. It requires the court to actually look at the facts and economics, and courts hate to do that. You know, they always go, oh, whoa, econ, come on now. So that's a question. Then the 301 and 232s, those are even more legally durable. Those have been tested in a lot of court cases. So I think the long and short of it is that we're going to be dealing with Trump tariffs of some form for a while. What IEEPA did and what the Supreme Court ruling did that is valuable is it removed easily the most destabilizing of the tariff tools, because IEEPA and all these other laws have procedures and they have substantive limitations and timelines and notice and comment rules and all these types of things, right? So what that prevents is it prevents a president from waking up on a Friday and not liking a Canadian television ad and imposing tariffs effective on a Monday, which of course Trump almost did. And so it takes that away. And that will, I think, actually be good for the economy, good for investors, good for manufacturers, good for everybody, in the sense that, yeah, you might end up still paying a 10, 15% tariff or higher, but at least you're going to know about it in advance and you're going to be able to plan accordingly. Because, you know, one of the things I learned as a very, very young corporate lawyer many moons ago was companies don't really hate taxes as much as they hate unpredictable and inconsistent taxes, right? They, you know, whatever rate it is, they'll deal with it. They'll complain probably if it's pretty high, but if it's consistent and predictable, and they can know that whatever tax it is today is going to be the tax they're going to pay in a year, they can plan around that, right? They can't plan around the law of the horse, right? They can't plan around Donald Trump's Canadian television commercial situation. And that is an additional drag. Some economists at the New York Fed a couple of years ago looked at the Trump 1.0 tariffs, the China mayhem, 2018, 2019, things got a little nuts there for a little bit. And they found that it cost us maybe $20 to $40 billion in foregone investment just because of the uncertainty. And they said that was just a big dampening effect, which makes perfect sense. If again, I was still in the corporate world back then, and I had clients just saying, we're waiting, we're just going to wait. So I think some of that goes away, but certainly not all of it because, again, he has all these other tools.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Yeah. I think that one thing that gets kind of lost in discussions about how much this administration is dragging on the economy, it's not just like the dollars that are remitted, right? When you have tariffs, it's this uncertainty. It's this like sense of lack of fairness. And like, is your product actually going to succeed because it's the best product and you have the best marketing and the most efficient, operations and what, like, you're actually finding new audiences? Or is it because of all of these other screwy interventions in the form of tariffs or in the form of Donald Trump taking an interest in your industry? Like another thing that you and I have talked about a bunch in the past, besides trade policy, is this sort of other forms of command and control type policy that is coming from this White House, including a bunch of equity stakes that the president has taken in companies. I looked this up right before we hopped on this recording. According to the Council on Foreign Relations, as of late April, the U.S. government has invested $21 billion across 16 deals involving direct ownership of American, or not just American companies, but of various kinds of companies that they're taking ownership in. You know, there's the Golden Share in U.S. Steel and an aluminum company and, various kinds of other mining companies. And I'm sure I'm forgetting some of the other highlights here.
No. And just this morning, the Wall Street Journal reported that we're taking equity stakes in 9 quantum computing companies.
There you go.
So we're up to like 25 companies. And, you know, again, as a libertarian, it's like curling my toes.
And Intel is another.
It's terrible. And you're already seeing, and to play off that a little bit more, you're already seeing evidence of the administration using that leverage to have those companies do things that might not make the most commercial sense, but they make maybe political sense or whatever.
So what's an example of that? Yeah.
Yeah, so U.S. Steel for years has been wanting to close a blast furnace facility in Granite City, Illinois. It's like 100 years old. It's had multiple like EPA infractions. It's a facility whose time has come, right? Blast furnace technology itself is it's antiquated and dirty, and we don't really even use it much anymore. So they were going to close it, but it's been a political football for ages. And finally, after the Trump administration approved Nippon Steel's purchase of U.S. Steel and got the golden share, Nippon Steel was following through with U.S. Steel's plan to shut down Granite City. And then the Wall Street Journal has reported Howard Lutnick gave them a call, and suddenly Granite City is, at first they were going to turn it into this weird jobs program where the mill wasn't even going to produce anything, but the workers were just going to work. I don't know. They were going to like babysit the equipment, and that got a lot of pushback. So the mill is now up and running. So one of the dirtiest steel mills in the country, if not the world at this point, is really only operating for political reasons, right? And that's, I think, a great example of how these equity stakes, the companies, they don't have a choice, even if it's not a majority stake, right?
Just to play devil's advocate for a second, like, what responsibility should the government have for the people who would lose their jobs at this mill, for example?
Right. Well, I mean, I would say that if there is a role, it's for like things like unemployment insurance or, you know, pensions. It's not for keeping the mill operating, this kind of antiquated, inefficient mill that is was going to be taken offline years ago, right? So you and I probably have slightly different views on what the government's role is in these situations. But I think we can agree that the focus should be on adjustment, not on just keeping make work jobs alive, especially at places that are, you know, belching out coal-fired pollution, right? So focus on adjustment. Don't keep these things operating. But in the long term, of course, the problem is that if you're dealing, let's say you're not dealing in steel, you're dealing in semiconductors and quantum computing, you want those companies to be really pushing the bleeding edge of innovation, right? You want them, especially in a field like semiconductors, where, you know, yields are everything. And if you're not operating at maximum efficiency, you're going to lose kind of the global race in the space. When the government starts worrying about things, or making you as a company worry about things other than those efficiencies, well, you over time you lose, right? You just become like a Jones Act shipping company, right? You know, old, costly zombie firm, not a tip, you know, kind of tip of the spear innovator. And so for steel, you know, you can go, okay, you know, so what? We got a blast furnace or whatever. Now I think they're going to do a tin mill facility. That's another political boondoggle. But in these really high tech areas, or these areas that have national defense, because they've been investing in national defense related companies like a rocket propulsion company, as well as rare earth magnets and a few of these other things. Well, that's where, like, it really, really matters that suddenly they're going to be making decisions for political reasons and not technological or commercial ones. The other, I think, big risk with these transactions, aside from the capital misallocation, right? Because stocks are going crazy in these companies, not, again, for commercial reasons, but because everybody's like, oh, too big to fail. But the other big risk is that you're going to see some of our other tech champions that don't have government stakes still getting into bed with the government companies because they're trying to curry favor with Trump, right? So Trump has asked SpaceX, Apple, and Nvidia, so three pretty tip of the spear companies, American companies, to do business with Intel. Right. Again, not because Intel makes as chips as good as TSMC, but because it's the American company and has the government stake. So, okay, that's going to be good for Intel, and Intel share price has gone up. But do we really want SpaceX and Nvidia and, you know, again, these American champions using subpar technology? Right. Look, I'm not going to be flying on a rocket anytime soon, but I would hope they're using the best equipment possible, right? And same goes for our military, you know, our fighter jets and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's that risk just increases every time there's another one of these deals announced. The risk goes further, right? That you're going to have more and more folks, you know, Spirit Airlines. Good old Spirit Airlines went to Trump and tried to get their own equity stake based on this precedent that they had already set with Intel and U.S. Steel and the rest. There's just all these really unseen problems with, and again, it goes back to capital misallocation, which just means less productivity, less growth, slower economy overall, which means just everybody a little poorer at the end of the day. And it's, you can't see it. You wake up and it's 20 years down the road and suddenly you're just not at the frontier. And that's where the big problem
is. So how do you explain then how China, which is like a much more openly command and control style economy, it's an authoritarian country, you know, and they're not necessarily keeping stuff, keeping plants alive because they're worried about political blowback, because they don't have to worry about voters voting them out of office. But they do have a much more authoritarian form of government and form of economy. And I think that there's a little bit of China envy that you see here in the United States. Not only from folks on the left, but also from the Trump land. And
yeah, for sure.
You know, our president just had a visit over there and met with President Xi. But how do you respond to those kinds of that China envy, you know, that kind right. of jealousy for the ability of the government to have more intervention in the economy and invest in many cases, like in the case of China, in some of the technologies of the future.
Right. So I think with China, you have to remember a few things. First is that a huge amount of China's economic success over the last 30 plus years has actually come from catch-up growth due to market-oriented reforms, right? And what I mean by that is that, you know, China before 1980 basically was harming itself with communism. And a lot of the rapid growth that China has saw in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and even now is the result of market-oriented reforms. And you know, some of it is trade liberalization, but a lot of it is property rights reform and all these kind of privatizations and the rest. So we have to kind of start with that. The second part is you have to note that China is still much, much poorer than the United States on a per capita basis. And what might make sense for a sort of an economy at the Chinese per capita income level probably might not make sense for an economy like the United States that is just very wealthy and still kind of already at the frontier in terms of productivity and the rest, right? So it might make sense for China to try to get ahead in ways that the United States wouldn't do. Another thing is, of course, China as an authoritarian regime can do some stuff economically that the United States can't do. Consumer suppression and worker suppression, right? Basically, keeping wages low and keeping consumers and savers kind of, you know, poorer than they should be is something that, you know, doesn't really fly in freer places. But finally, you know, when you talk about Chinese industrial policy, you have to look at it in the big picture. And the big picture of Chinese industrial policy is there are some quote unquote successes, some things where, yes, I mean, if you look at Chinese EVs and solar panels and a few other areas, they've really made some incredible strides. But the cost of the broader industrial schemes they put together is massive. So you go back to capital misallocation. There was a great paper from some IMF economists now about a year ago. And they said that Chinese industrial policy was shaving something like 3% of their GDP every year. So on a compounding basis over the last 30 years. And that's trillions of dollars in wealth that has been lost because China has pursued this top-down industrial policy, state capitalist model. Now, hey, maybe again, if you're China and you're kind of an up-and-coming nation, you're trying to get ahead in a couple areas or achieve certain geopolitical goals, that makes sense. It wouldn't make sense for us to do that, right? And then, of course, you have to look at the rest of China's economy. Leaving aside, right, they've had a bunch of industrial policy failures, aerospace, semiconductors. There are still areas where the United States is way, way ahead in the tech race. But even leaving aside the big industrial policy failures, China's economy is not in great shape. They are battling households that don't want to spend any money, huge kind of capital misallocation issues with overcapacity in certain industries, private and government debt they make us look like we're thrifty. Their productivity levels are still well below frontier. And when I say frontier, I mean like the best developed countries in the world, the Germanys, Switzerland's, the United States of the world, we're at the frontier. China's productivity is still way behind the frontier overall. That matters, right, for being wealthy and prosperous. Demographic issues, thanks to the one-child policy, they're going to get really old really fast and before they get rich. So China's economy is one of those things where it's two-faced. There is certainly this humming export machine that makes a ton of stuff, and some of it is really high quality. But there is a other economy the other, which is pretty darn bad. And again, you have to ask, if you're the United States, why would you want to pursue that model if you're already at the frontier? Maybe you need to do some of this for national defense, right? Because, you know, even a Milton Friedman guy like me would say, sure, okay, national defense is an exception. So you need, whether it's tariffs or Buy American rules or long-term contracts or stockpiles, if there's like a really tight defense nexus, fine. But that's not what we're talking about, right? We're just talking about, I mean, U.S. steel, right? Mm-hmm. Automobiles, just not like, you know.
Footwear.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, you can go down the list, right? And then, oh, don't even get it started on things like banana tariffs and whatever. I mean, that makes no sense. So there's not any sort of, they just want, it's just, they're going to kind of China-fy the whole economy, not just focus on national defense. And then I think the other thing though, is that we have strengths that China doesn't have, and I wish we were using them, right? We're just very open and dynamic. And our strengths are in, you know, more open trade and immigration and in letting kind of the free market and capital markets do their things. They are really, really good at a lot of things, not everything. And yet these guys, they seem to want to play away from those strengths, right? And again, do more China stuff.
I think, you know, our president has expressed open admiration for for this kind of state level intervention, not unique to China. A lot of other strong men run countries, right, that have this kind of intervention. And yeah. It's hard for me to know how much of that is just like he's personally envious of having that kind of power, and how much of it is like just a genuine philosophical difference that he thinks that is how you strengthen and how you make an economy great again, you know?
Yeah,
because he sees models like China that seem to be succeeding at least on some fronts, and maybe misattribute what is behind the success versus failure, at least as you have described things.
Yeah, my guess is that it's a combination of those both, really. You know, part of it is just this kind of strong man, you know, I alone can fix mentality. I think the other thing that plays into it is he comes from the business world. And, you know, running the macro economy is not like running a business. In fact, somebody recently had a pretty good piece on this that, you know, actually businessmen make terrible presidents, right? They make, because it's not a corporate balance sheet is not like the trade deficit. I'm sorry, it's just not, right? And you know, the global economy, the U.S. economy are these kind of open dynamic systems that you cannot just pull lever and next, you know, widget come out, right? It's just not like that, right? And there's all these unintended consequences. There's, you know, millions of people engaging in billions of transactions. It's this incredibly wonderful, untamable, organic beast. And you can't reduce it to line items on a balance sheet. And I think though, as the kind of business mentality is, oh, well, yeah, well, of course I just take an equity stake here and I just push this button there and boom, I run the economy. And I think that, you know, you look at a lot of the folks in his administration, you know, a guy like Lutnick as well, like these guys come from this world where, oh yeah, you just pull the lever and boom, economy go. And I think that's actually obviously a big problem.
Well, I think that is a perfect place to end about how the Trump administration is run by businessmen/socialists. It's in equal measure, perhaps, depending on your vantage point. Scott Linsacombe, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me today about the world's sexiest topic of tariffs and capitalism. And thanks to everyone for listening.
My pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.